Prayer Part 1, the sixth talk in a series entitled Being a Spiritual Person, was presented by Ron Julian on October 31st, 2006 at McKenzie Study Center's Tuesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're continuing on tonight in our series on being a spiritual person. And tonight I want to start talking about the role that prayer has in the life of a spiritual person. And let me make clear to you where I'm coming from here. I mean, it is not by any means my intention to say everything there is to say about prayer or claim that I'm an expert on what prayer is supposed to be, but it has always been my goal with these sort of things to try to get a picture for myself of what it is that the Bible is talking about with this stuff. That is, what's at the heart of it? The Bible has a lot to say about prayer. It is always telling me to pray. And I have tried to understand what it is it's getting at. Why is it saying this? What does it want me to do? Does it want me to spend so many hours a day praying? Does it want me to say certain things? Does it want me to change the world? What does it want me to do? And for our purposes here, for this class, we want to try to connect it with this idea of spirituality. What role does it play in being a spiritual person? Does it promote spirituality? Is it a result of spirituality? What exactly is the Bible getting at here? Let me remind you of what I've been saying in the class so far. A spiritual person is a person in whom the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, is at work. That's the biblical picture of spirituality. That work is a work that's done in our hearts, making us willing to see the truth of things, especially the truth about God and ourselves, the issues that I confront as I am growing in spirituality in real-life situations. And we talked a little bit about this, what kinds of things are trials confronting me with. I'm having to decide in real life that God is real and that He is good. I'm having to decide in real life that the kingdom of God is where the true riches are, that that's what I want out of life. I'm having to admit in real life that I am in need of God's mercy. I'm having to learn in real life to see others as being equally important as myself. And we can sum it up by saying that growth in spirituality involves persevering in faith, holding to the truths of God amidst the pressures of life that would push me away from those truths. It is persevering in the faith and the implications of the faith in the midst of real life. That's the place where spiritual growth, I think, is really happening, as the Bible paints this picture. So what I want to talk tonight about is what relationship prayer has with all of that, because I think it has a lot of relationship with that. The admonitions that the Bible gives us to pray are basically another version of the admonitions that we see to persevere in faith, to believe that God is there, to admit that we are sinners, and so on. So tonight and next week, I want to talk just a little bit about why we pray and why the Bible is telling us to pray and what that has to do with spirit. Let me start by just giving you a little picture of how I see this. Sometimes people talk about prayer as if it is a technique or a discipline that I am supposed to take on with, in general, I mean, there are all sorts of versions, but there are two kinds of things that people will point to. First of all, prayer is a technique that I can use to make my life better. I can get more of what I want in life if I am praying in the right way. And We could just wander down to any Christian bookstore right now, I'm quite sure. I mean, last time I looked, there were a number of them. Books that are basically about how to pray successfully, how to get better results from your prayer than you're getting right now. So that's one of the things that prayer is seen as a means towards. And then the other is prayer as a means of enhancing my spirituality, as a technique to make me a more spiritual person. And in my looking at the Bible and trying to understand what the Bible is talking about when it talks about prayer, my answer would be basically neither of those things are really at the center of what the Bible is talking about. It's not as if prayer doesn't have something to do with asking God for things and receiving answers to those requests. It does. And it's not as if it doesn't have something to do with my own growth and spirituality, because it does. But the idea that somehow prayer is a thing that I need to take on so that I can enhance my current situation, that's not the biblical picture at all. I'd say the biblical picture of prayer is a more fundamental one. That prayer, in essence, is a non-negotiable. It is a part of being a person of faith. And let me just kind of give you a picture of what I'm talking about. I want to use the parable of the prodigal son, which in and of itself is not exactly a parable about prayer, but I just want to think about that picture for a second. You remember the story? There are two sons, and one of them wants his inheritance. Give me my part of the estate. And he runs off, and he squanders it all, and he lives a dissolute life, and he ends up with nothing. And finally, he realizes that he could go back to his father and ask him to hire him, take me on as a hired hand, and I'd be better off than I am now. And when the father sees the son coming to him, the son asks him to hire him as a hired hand, but the father embraces him and throws a big party because his son is back. It's as if he were dead and now he's living again. Okay, well, if we think about this request, this son deciding, I'm going to go to my father and ask him for help. I'm destitute, I'm in trouble. I'm going to go to my father and ask him to hire me so that I will not be starving and destitute the way I am. If you think about the order of events, first of all, the son is sitting amidst the squalor and he stops to think and he realizes, what am I doing? I shouldn't be here. I should go to my father and ask him for help and ask him to hire me. And then, having made this decision, he goes to the father and he makes this request to him. So, the prayer was partly, it's true, a means to an end. I mean, he was in trouble and he went and asked the father for help because he wanted help. And in fact, he got the help that he needed, and in fact, he got more than what he was asking for. But in the story, the prayer, his going to the Father and asking for this help, was really, in a more important sense, an end in itself. It was the fact that he decided to go back, to say, I messed up. I shouldn't have done this, but I'm apologizing. I shouldn't have done it. Hire me as your hired hand. It's his coming to his senses and going and making that request that is in itself a significant event. It's not that his request to the Father was a technique that he used. Let's see, how could I enhance my current situation? I'll make this request and things will go better. He came to a realization about himself and what he had done, and he decided to go back. And it's that deciding to go back that was the significant event. So we can see that in the way the father, he sees him at a distance and goes running out to him. He hasn't even heard any request yet, but the very fact that he's coming back to him is a big deal. He has obviously decided to come back to me. And it is that that is the big deal to the father. Well, I don't know if I'm being clear here as to what I'm trying to get across, but That's how I think about the sort of thing that prayer is in the Bible. Prayer is a way of living out my faith. It is a place where I am engaging with the God that I have previously spurned and disobeyed and rejected, and I am coming back to Him, and I am seeking from Him that which He has promised. So, all of the issues we have talked about for the last several weeks, I find confronted, they confront me in the issue of prayer. In prayer, I wrestle, first of all, with the question of whether God exists and is trustworthy. Is He the one to go to? In prayer, I wrestle with the question of whether I am going to persevere in trusting this God or whether I'm going to give up on Him. In prayer, I wrestle with the question about what I really want. I'm having to decide, what is it I'm looking for in life? In prayer, I wrestle with the question of whether I will admit my own unworthiness and need for mercy. And in prayer, I wrestle with the issue of whether I care about other people. And I would argue that all of those things we find in the biblical teaching on prayer. That the biblical teaching on prayer is not just teaching about prayer. It is basically, in one form or another, an admonition for me to persevere and to confront those four areas that I've been talking about in class. Confront the question of who God is and whether He exists and what it is I want in life and how I think about myself and how I think about others. Prayer is one of those places where I'm going to confront those issues. And that's why the Bible talks about it, I would say. So I want to start on that theme tonight, show you partly how that's the case, and then next week I will finish this up and I'll try to put the whole picture together. But let's just start with an obvious one. I mean, that question of whether God exists. I mean, this is pretty obvious, obviously. In order to pray, I have to come to terms with the question of God's existence. If God isn't there, who am I praying to? Now, we don't want to be simplistic about this because the fact is that all kinds of people pray in all kinds of circumstances who may not have actually come to terms with the issue of God's existence. You know, we're all familiar with the phrase, there are no atheists in foxholes. The idea being that you put the pressure on enough, and if I feel under the gun enough, I will call out to whoever, hoping, not that I'm necessarily convinced that there's anyone there, but I need help, so I'm calling for help. And if I get it, that'll be great. So prayer can arise from all sorts of attitudes. Obviously, what the Bible is concerned with is, as we were talking about from Hebrews, that idea that I must come to terms with the idea that God exists and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. That I am praying to God because I believe He's there, and because He is the one to go to. He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. There is no better place to go. There is no other rewarder to be found. So, in this fundamental sense, prayer is the place where I do business with God, or at least one of the places where I do business with God. I am a person, and I am talking to my Creator, another person, the one who gave me my existence, the one who knows me better than I know myself. I am going to Him because I think He's there and He is the one to go to. This, though, is really only the beginning, I think, because for the most part, the Bible just assumes this of prayer. The Bible is being written to people, pretty much all of whom would have said they believe in God. Believing in God is not really the big deal. I mean, in our culture, where more and more people are willing to say that they don't believe in God, it might seem like a big deal. But to pray to a God who you think is out there is a commonplace sort of thing. The real issue is, what sort of a God do I believe in? Who is this God that I'm praying to? And how do I think about Him and what He wants and what He has promised and who I am and all of that? So, although, yes, the first fundamental issue I confront is, is God there? And I'm going to pray to him if I think he is, and I'm not going to if I don't think he is. That's really the beginning part. And as I say, the Bible doesn't really advocate that much. I mean, it doesn't talk about prayer in those terms that much because there's so much more involved. The issue is more, how do I think about this God? And what is it that I think that I need from this God? And those sorts of things. Because what we pray arises out of what we believe and what we value and what we want. Remember, we talked before about the parable of the tax gatherer and the Pharisee. And the Pharisee is praying. He's praying in some ways a very exemplary prayer. He's thanking God for all the good things he's done and everything. But he's not commended in the prayer in that parable for praying. The fact that he believes in God and that he's praying to God is not the significant issue. The significant issue is how does he think about himself in relationship to this God that he's praying to. And the problem is that he thinks that he's hot stuff and he's thanking God for making him hot stuff. So the situation is not here is an exemplary theist praying to his God, but here is a self-righteous person who has misunderstood his relationship to that God. So, again, the teaching in the Bible about prayer fundamentally is teaching about having a certain attitude towards that God and toward myself and so on. So, the teaching on prayer in the Bible is about those other sorts of issues for the most part. Do I trust this God? Will I persevere in following this God? Will I confess my own unworthiness? Will I pursue the things that are really of value? Those sorts of things are the things that the Bible talks about when it talks about prayer. So tonight, I want to just talk about one aspect of that. And the issue I want to talk about tonight is the way prayer relates to my perseverance in faith. And this is a theme that the Bible talks about quite a bit, and I think it's a theme that is sometimes misunderstood. The relationship between perseverance and prayer is a very important one, I think, but sometimes it's misunderstood as to what exactly the Bible's getting at here. What I'd like to argue is that the Bible portrays prayer of a certain kind as being a way of actually living out my faith, of actually persevering in being a person of faith. And in fact, some of what I'm going to talk about tonight arises from the thesis that I just did going back to North Carolina to finish that off. I wrote about two parables, the parable of the friend at midnight and the parable of the unjust judge. And these are parables both that have to do in some way with prayer and in some way with the concept of perseverance in prayer. So this is something I've been thinking about here recently. So I want to start. The one I want to talk about tonight is in Luke 18. This is the parable of the unjust judge. And there's a lot that could be said here. I'm just going to touch on a few things to make the point that I want to make tonight. It's helpful to understand as we start to read this parable that I would argue, for a variety of reasons, that it should be understood as being a part of the preceding context, that it's all part of the same thing. And in the preceding context, Jesus is talking about basically his second coming. In verse 22, he said to the disciples in chapter 17 of Luke, "The days shall come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it." And that's the thing that he's starting with here. That the Son of Man, Jesus, is going to have his day. There is going to be this time coming when it will be his day. He's going to come back. He is going to establish his kingdom and so on. His day is coming. But there are going to be days ahead of you where you will long to see one of those days, but you won't see it. It's not going to be there. I think that sets us up for the theme that we find in the parable of the unjust judge, that Jesus is talking about the longing for the return of the Son of Man, but things are going to go on just as they always have until finally the Son of Man will be revealed. And it is that day that his disciples are waiting for and longing for, that day when the Son of Man is revealed. And so then, starting in Luke 18, "Now he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart." Now, right off the bat, let me stop there and say, when he says not to lose heart, I think this relates back to the sort of thing that he had been talking about. "The day shall come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it." That he is about to discuss the experience of his people, really from that time until now. This desire for him to come and make things right, for him to come and fix the world, to bring life and justice and righteousness to the world, and yet things seem to go on, and they haven't changed. They're still the way that they always have been. And that not lose heart is not just a general sort of, hey, keep praying and don't give up and maybe God will give you what you want. But this is a more fundamental, are you going to despair or not? You face the question whether you're going to give up on God or not. And hopefully you see why I say that as we go along through here. But I think it arises from out of what he's been saying in the previous chapter. Then he tells the parable, saying, "There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And there was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, 'Give me legal protection from my opponent.' And for a while he was unwilling, but afterward he said to himself, 'Even though I do not fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection, lest by continually coming she wear me out.' And the Lord said, 'Hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night, and will he delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them speedily. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?'" Okay, so I want to point to that Son of Man theme, first of all, that started in chapter 17. Longing to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. So he tells them this parable so that they would not lose heart. And the conclusion of the parable is God will bring about justice for his elect. He will vindicate. Really, he will avenge his elect, is what it says there. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? One of the big themes in the Old Testament was the idea that the coming kingdom of God and the Messiah who would rule over the kingdom of God was going to establish justice on the earth. That now the rulers of this earth, in many ways, bring about suffering and injustice for the people who live here, but the coming of the Messiah will ultimately establish justice. And in the New Testament, we see the same theme. We find Paul talking about how the coming of Christ will be that time when his people will be vindicated and avenged for all that they have suffered as his people. So the idea that the coming of the Christ, the coming of the Messiah, is God's ultimate answer to the cries of his people for justice is a very common theme in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And I think it's important for us to see that wraparound theme here, that this parable about prayer is in the context of longing to see the days of the Son of Man, encouraging us that God will indeed answer the cries of his elect for justice, but when the Son of Man comes, he says, and I'm understanding him to mean, when he comes in answer to those prayers, when he comes to finally bring the justice that God has promised from the beginning, will there be anyone who is still expecting him? So, now, this is important, I think, to understand the point that Jesus is making about prayer here. Let me jump into the story now. It's a story about a widow, a needy person in this social setting. She has no social standing, really. Without her husband, she's very vulnerable. The Old Testament has a lot to say about the obligation of judges to deal fairly with widows. That is, it's easy to overlook them because they have no social standing. All the more reason why it was obligatory for a judge to consider the case of the widow and deal with her fairly and not ignore her and push her aside. But that's exactly what's happening in this story, is the judge has no interest in the widow. He doesn't care about what people think about him. He doesn't care about her. He doesn't fear God or fear man. I don't care what God thinks about me. I don't care what's right. Probably what he's looking for from her is a bribe, and she's not in a position to give it, so he's not interested in giving her justice. She has to face this decision. What am I going to do? I keep going back, and this judge has no interest in me. He doesn't care about me, and he doesn't care about justice. What am I going to do? I could give up. I could just despair and say, well, I guess I'm not going to get justice. Or I could keep going back. And she decides, I'm going to keep going back. And finally, for reasons that are a little obscure, either the judge doesn't want to be bugged by her continually coming back, or it's theoretically possible that he's concerned that she will get so mad that she will punch him in the face, although this is the less likely way of translating it, but it could be. Literally is what it says. It's lest she give me a black eye, lest she punch me in the face and give me a black eye, is what it says literally. But is he really concerned that this widow is going to punch him out? Another possibility is that it's an idiom that has something to do with his reputation, that it's going to become known to everybody that he mistreats widows, something like that. So he has his reasons. It's either he doesn't want to be bugged, or he doesn't want everybody to think he's a bad guy, or he's afraid he's going to get punched, or whatever. But he decides, I don't care anything about her, but I guess I'll give it to her because it's better. It'll just be better for me to do that. And then what Jesus says is, what I understand him to be saying is, listen to what happened there. The unrighteous judge said yes. He was saying no, and yet she kept going back, and finally he said yes. Now, how much more certain is it that God will answer the cries of his elect for justice? I mean, this God that we're dealing with now, this is not a judge who doesn't care about what's right. This is the righteous creator of the world. This is the one who cares more about justice than I do. And we're not talking about a judge who doesn't care about the person who has asked. This is the God who is dealing with his elect. These are his chosen people. So how could it be that God would not keep his promise to bring about justice, to vindicate his people, when it is his people and justice and rightness is the thing that he cares about more than anything else? How could it possibly be that God would not answer the cries of his people for justice? But why does Jesus tell a story like this with a widow who has to keep going back and seems she gets the answer no, and she has to decide whether she's going to go back again? I think it's because in the context that he's talking about here, there we will be longing to see one of the days of the Son of Man, that the fact is that, as he says, God's elect cry to him day and night. That the people of God cry out to God day and night to make things right. And yet, I mean, it's not that there is no answer ever coming. Sometimes things get better. But fundamentally, The call for God to make things right, to vindicate his people, still is very far from being fulfilled in the way that he has promised that it will be. When is that going to happen? When is God going to do what he promised to do for his people? It will happen when Jesus returns to establish his kingdom. So, the argument that Jesus is making here is, look, I want to encourage you, in the midst of the difficulties that I know you as my people are going to face, as you're waiting to see the days of the Son of Man come, when you're waiting for the Son of Man to bring about what he has promised, let me encourage you. Do not give up on going back to God, on going to God, crying to him day and night. God, bring about the justice you have promised. Make things right. Don't give up on going to him, because think about this widow. She had no reason to think that that judge was ever going to be on her side, and yet she kept going back. It was the right thing to do there. She ended up getting it. And if it was right for her to go back with a judge like that, how much more does it make sense that you would keep going back to the God who cares about you and who has promised to do right by you? So his encouragement to pray here at the beginning, he was telling them at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart. He is, and I stole this phrase from Jack many years ago. Jack may remember a sermon he taught at the church we used to work at many, many years ago called Prayer or Despair. And that's kind of what this is about. Are you going to give up? Are you going to despair? Or are you going to pray? Are you going to go back to God again? Because you are confident that he is the one to go to and that he will keep his promises. So I think this is a very, very important parable and an important teaching on prayer, because of the picture it gives us of prayer as a living out of my perseverance in faith. I keep going back to God because I am convinced that God is the one to go to. Even when it seems like things are not going the way I would like them to go, I keep going back to God because I'm convinced that he is the one. He is good, he is powerful, he keeps his promises, and so he is the one I'm going to turn to. Now, in this parable, it's important to note what's at issue is praying to God for vindication, for God to come and make things right, to show that he is on the side of his people, to show that he is against those who have sought their destruction, that he is coming to establish righteousness and make a place where those who are his people can dwell in security and holiness and so on. I mean, this is what I'm looking to God for. And in this parable, that's what the issue is, and Jesus' assurance is, look, think about it. Think about who God is. Think about his character. How could it be that he would not answer this request? He will. So in this parable, the assurance is absolutely, positively, you can count on God will indeed say yes to these prayers, in this case, for vindication, for justice. I look at the world and say, this is not right. God, make it right. And I can have absolute confidence that God will indeed do that. He has promised to do it, and I can count on him to do it. So I'm persevering in prayer in this situation because I am confident that God will indeed do what I am asking, because he has promised to do it. I'm not going to talk about this parable tonight, but the other parable that I did my thesis on, The Friend at Midnight, I think is often misunderstood to be teaching that if we keep going back to God over and over again, that we will get what we want. But I think the theme of that parable, what it's teaching instead, is the certainty. I can count on the fact that God will say yes to my prayers. But once again, I have to ask the question, what kind of prayers are we talking about? And in the context of where the friend at midnight is found, the surrounding it is the discussion of the Lord's Prayer, the kinds of prayers that I see there in the Lord's Prayer, praying for God's kingdom to come and for forgiveness and deliverance and so on. Again, once again, I can count on, I can be certain that God will say yes to those requests. Very similar in that sense to this parable, that assurance that I can count on God to do what I am asking Him to do. Therefore, it makes sense for me to go back to Him. It makes sense for me to ask Him for these things because He has promised to do them. Now, there is a second kind of perseverance in prayer that has to do with those sorts of issues where God has not promised me a specific result. That is, He has promised that He is going to bring justice ultimately. He has promised that He will forgive those who seek forgiveness from Him. He will give life to those who seek life. He will give wisdom to those who seek wisdom. But we look at those sorts of situations that we find in the Bible, like Paul saying he had a thorn in the flesh. We don't know what it was, but he talks about how he went three times to God, asking God to remove this thorn in the flesh. And the answer that he got was basically, no, I'm not going to. I have a purpose for that thorn in the flesh, and it's going to stay. The great example of this, of course, is the Garden of Gethsemane, where there can be no question about the holiness, righteousness, or faith of the one praying. When Jesus was praying to the Father, let this cup pass away from me. But the fact is, the cup did not pass away from him. He went through the crucifixion, even though he prayed to God to exempt him from it. He's basically saying, if it be your will, get me out of this. I don't want to do this. Well, those sorts of prayers, I would argue, are biblical and appropriate. I am in trouble. I am troubled at heart. Where do I turn? Where do I go? I turn to God. I turn to the one who made me. I turn to the one who has promised to deliver me, who has promised to bless me ultimately. And here I am in the midst of a difficult thing, and I'm praying to God, God, I'm looking to you. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to make that person stop mistreating me. I want you to find me the right person to marry, or whatever the thing I might be asking. The thing is, though, I don't have a promise or assurance from God that that particular thing I'm asking for I'm going to get. And so I ask in that situation the way Jesus asked, not my will, but thine be done. I'm saying, but why am I going to God? Why am I turning to him at all? Because I trust him. So I might continue to go to God in the midst of some difficulty in my life. It may be a difficulty that lasts for some time. Asking God for relief, asking God for a certain kind of help. I want it to turn out this way. I want this pain to go away, or I want this thing that I don't have to be mine. I'm asking because I want it, and that's all right. I mean, that's a fine thing. And I'm asking God because I trust him, because I think he is there, and he's the one who is on my side. So this, I think, is what gives rise to the sort of language that we see, like in Philippians, where Paul says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, make your requests known to God. In everything, be anxious for nothing. Whatever may be pressing on you, remember who God is and go to him. Make your requests known to God. Paul's concern in his teaching on prayer in these circumstances, I believe, when he says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, make your requests known to God, His concern is that there is nothing that is exempt from it. There is nothing that comes into my life that I look at and say, there's no point in going to God about this. I have given up thinking that God is the one to go to with something along these lines. We can see that same thing in the language in 1 Thessalonians, where he says, "Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks." Well, the always and without ceasing and in everything is the key to understanding what he's getting at there. You may have, along with me, had trouble figuring out what he means when he says, pray without ceasing. And I mean, in my working on my thesis, I did some reading in Luther, and Luther valiantly tried to figure out, you know, how this could be, and he was explaining how, well, you know, like, if you're a cobbler and you're working, you can use part of your mind to be working on the shoes, while the other part of your mind can be praying, so that you're praying all the time. Well, I don't think this is what Paul was getting at. That's not what he means by pray without ceasing. Notice, he says, rejoice always. The idea is, any human being is going to rejoice at good things that come along and going to be bummed out about bad things. I'm not going to rejoice in the midst of difficulties. Likewise, any human being can be grateful when somebody does something nice for them, but when difficulties are there, then of course I'm not going to be grateful in the midst of that. Well, but that's what he's saying. Rejoice always, in everything give thanks. It is remembering that even though times are hard now, the fact is God is good, and he answers the cries of anyone who will turn to him. And in the end, his reward is life. I mean, you want life, you want to be blessed, you want relief, you want to find meaning and purpose and joy and righteousness and fulfillment in your life. This is what God has promised to those who turn to him. Now, is it a hard road getting there? Yeah. Is it tough along the way to get there? Yes. But this is what God has promised for his people. So even when things are tough, rejoice. Not because you're having a hard time, but because you know the God that is taking you through these circumstances. In everything, give thanks. Not because everything that comes your way is good in itself, not because everything that comes your way is enjoyable or without pain or without evil involved with it, but I am dealing with the God who works all things together for good for his people. So my joy and my gratitude is based in what I know that God has promised to do, that he has his hand on my life and he will not let go, and he is taking me just where I want to go. So Paul's admonition here is not a simple, hey, let's be happy and let's be grateful. It is in the midst of everything. When you have figured out who God is and what he's doing, everything that comes your way, you can see in the light of this bigger thing that he is doing. And it is in that context that he says, pray without ceasing. That is, always in everything. Not just in those situations where you're feeling good and say, hey, God seems to be doing pretty well by me, I think I'll pray to God here. But it is precisely in those spots where you are being pressured to think, what is the point in going to God? Because things are just going on the way they always have. What's the point? It is then that you want to not stop praying. You want to keep going to him because you know that he is the one to go to, that he is doing right by you. So that's how I understand what pray without ceasing means. It is, don't give up. Not every minute of the day be thinking about God and praying to him, but never come to that place where you would say, I'm not going to go to him anymore. Pray without ceasing. Don't stop. Don't give up. Which is what Jesus was saying in the parable of the unjust judge. Don't lose heart, but at all times pray. Well, That's the theme that I wanted to talk about tonight. Prayer in this kind of way of looking at it, in these passages, prayer is not so much a way of making nifty things happen in my life. Prayer is this decision that I am making that I am going to hang in there with God. I'm going to keep going back to Him because I believe that He is there and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. And that's why I keep going back. So perseverance in prayer, then, in this context, is not so much, I have read books on prayer where people say things like, the concern is, how do you get what you want from God? You know, I'm asking God for, I'm having some financial difficulties and I want God to bring a big pile of money my way. What should I do? And I have read books on prayer that point to these kinds of passages and say, well, see, you got to persevere. You got to hang in there. And I can remember one book saying, when you pray to God for something, the answer is born in heaven, and it's kind of on its way, winging towards you. But if you were to give up praying before it got there, it'll be aborted. It was born, but it didn't make it. And there are all these aborted prayer requests floating around out there because people didn't hang on long enough to get the thing that they were praying for. Well, that has nothing to do with what these passages are talking about. That's not the kind of perseverance in prayer that we're talking about here. I mean, there are two different versions of this, both of which are very important. One of them being, I persevere in calling out to God for those things that He has promised to do because I am confident that He will keep His promises. I do not stop because I believe that He will do what He has promised to do. And then, related to that, a similar thing but a little bit different, is I persevere in going to God with whatever my concerns might be, asking Him for whatever it is I think I need at the moment, because I trust Him, I think He's on my side, and even if He does not see it the way I do, and He doesn't answer my prayer the way I would like it to be answered, I still see Him as the one to go to. I keep going back to Him because I see Him as being on my side. The reason I make a distinction between those things is that there are kind of two sorts of faith that we're talking about here. If God has promised to do something, then the appropriate sort of faith is to tenaciously believe that it will happen, because He has said that it will. When it comes to, I have a thorn in the flesh and I would like it removed, I don't have a promise that the thorn in the flesh is going to be removed, but I do have confidence in God. And so I go to Him looking for the removal of the thorn in the flesh, even though maybe that's not the way it's going to turn out. But I can't go to Him saying, I know You're going to do this. And if that were our topic, we could, if we're talking about the nature of faith, it would be very important to make that distinction. That kind of faith that says, I know this will happen, and that kind of faith that says, I don't know whether this will happen, but I know that God is good. There's a difference between those two things that's very important. But the thing that I wanted to talk about tonight is, if we think about the relationship between prayer and spiritual maturity, we're not done by any means. There's lots of other sorts of passages to look at and other issues regarding prayer. But these sorts of passages are very important in understanding prayer. And the relationship between spiritual maturity and prayer in this case is not pray in order that you can produce spiritual maturity, but rather prayer is the working out of and result of spiritual maturity. That is, it is making that decision that I am not going to give up on God and I am going to turn to Him again. That is, in these examples, that's where the real action is happening. It is in not despairing. In the midst of a difficult world and a difficult life, to be trusting and even grateful. I mean, Paul, in a number of these contexts where he talks about this sort of thing, he almost always talks about being grateful in the midst of it, of actually understanding so well what it is that God is doing that I am grateful for it. In spite of the suffering that I'm going through, I am grateful for what God is doing with me and where He's taking me. So, in this case, prayer is essential, but not because prayer is a discipline or technique that will produce spiritual maturity, but rather prayer is the arena in which I am wrestling with the question of whether I trust God, and in the wrestling with that question and deciding to trust Him, spiritual maturity will be the result. Now, there's a lot more to say about prayer, and we'll talk about more of that next week, but as I have looked at these passages and tried to understand what the Bible has to say about this, I think this is a very good place to start, to get this as a foundation, to see fundamentally what's at stake is whether I am going to be the sort of person who trusts God, who believes that He is there, and sees Him as the source of what I need in life, so I keep going back to Him. That's the question I'm facing. And those who do that, who persevere in seeing God in that way, who keep going back to Him, in the end, the result will be they will get what they're asking for. That is, you're going to God for life, and in the end, life is what you're going to get. You're going to God for blessing, and in the end, blessing is what you're going to get. It is the one who hangs in there with God, that's the one that God is going to hang in there with, and in the end, will bring their life to its triumphant culmination. But prayer, then, in these passages, is not a spiritual technique so much as it is an arena in which I am deciding to be a person of faith. And that's a very important thing, I think, to understand about prayer. Now, like I say, there's more to be said, and we'll talk about that next time. But if you want to understand what prayer has to do with being a spiritual person, the place to start is to recognize that the spiritual person is the one who does not give up on God and who keeps going back to Him. That's at least a starting point. And we can talk about more of that picture next time. Okay, well, there's some stuff that we can talk about. I'm done with my comments. Any questions or comments that you might have, and we are passing the mic around so that we can come back later and find out if you said anything that we want to charge you with later on.
Yeah. Of a book, you could point out that that your prayer will get lost sort of in the cosmos if you stop persevering. And I know, like, that
comes from Daniel, right? That's probably what the argument is, right?
Yes.
And so I've heard that a lot, and I often expect to hear when I'm listening to a talk on perseverance with respect to prayer, I often expect to hear that, and I've never quite known what to do with it, and my Bible's still in NIV, so I'm still not sure what it's talking about.
Okay.
But can you shed any light on that instance in Daniel?
I would have to look at the passage in Daniel to be able to speak to that. Let me say this as a general sort of response, that this is the framework within which I would probably think about that issue. I'm not saying that God does not at times, for our own sake, make us wait. I mean, there's something that we're wrestling with, we're crying out to God about, and it is His intention to say yes to what we are asking, but He doesn't intend to do it right away. And in fact, part of His agenda is, I have to be patient. I have to be trusting him and persevering in going back to him and not giving up on him. And he's, in fact, giving me this scenario in which I am actually living that out. And in the end, yes, he fully intends to give me what I'm asking for. That's, in fact, in general, the way he's dealing with all of us. The promises of the gospel, they are promises in front of us. Why didn't he just grab me and take me to heaven? You know, I say, okay, I'm a Christian. He said, okay, well, let's go. Instead, we have this educational experience that we're living out where we're having to actually trust God along the way over a significant period of time. So I'm not saying that in my own life you may not have the experience where I'm asking God for something and I had to persevere in asking him and finally I got the thing that I had been asking him for. Many people have had experiences like that. So I'm not saying that that wouldn't ever happen or that I shouldn't. I mean, at any rate, I should be persevering in going to God in the midst of all of that, not out of a theology of if I keep it up, I know I'll get it, but out of the theology that says, I know that God is good and he's the one to go to, so I'm going to keep going back to him. So if I encounter a situation in the Bible where God delays in responding to something, that's not evidence that, I mean, that's evidence that God, in fact, does that sort of thing sometimes, and that's not surprising. But that's not counter evidence that God always, with everything that I ask for, is saying, if you just keep asking me long enough, I'm eventually going to give it to you. I mean, the thing that I was concerned about with the two parables that I looked at in my thesis is both of these parables emphasize very strongly the answer will be yes. And I think it's important for us to understand what kinds of prayers Jesus is talking about when he says the answer will be yes. He is not saying that the answer to every prayer will be what I want it to be. But if you back up and think about it in more general terms, the prayer to God for blessing and life, the answer will be yes. Or if you think about it more specifically, you know, I want this job or something like that, then no, I don't have a promise that the answer will be yes. And it doesn't matter, I could keep bugging God for 10 years and I don't have an assurance that I'm going to get that job because I keep asking him. And that's the thing that I think we need to guard against. I can be totally confident that God will keep his promises, and I can be totally confident that God is working for my good however things are going, but I can't be totally confident that I'm going to get things that God has not promised to give me. And that distinction is important. But as far as the Daniel passage is concerned, I'd have to look at it again. I don't remember the details very well, so...
Did I still need to talk to this? If you ever do come up with any idea about what that's talking about, because I'd love to know, because that hand in hand with that passage goes people often talking about demonic activity and praying in tongues and all right. sorts of things like that. And right. when people say talk about praying without ceasing, they're usually talking about combating, you know, some prince of Persia somewhere too. And
right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, I know. I know. Okay, well, I'll try to remember to look at that. But it's been a long time since I've looked at Daniel, so. Well, we're talking about the angel, the archangel, right, Michael? Was she just asking what the story was?
Oh, it's Daniel 10, the whole chapter 10.
Okay.
And verse then Michael gets involved, and they have an like they go at this fighting.
Right. Right. It's just, yeah. Okay. Well, I won't speak off the cuff. Let me think about that one.
Ron, well, how do you think Paul knew after the third time that the answer was no?
Well, he gives a very specific description of what it is that God told him.
So
God said to me, my power is perfected in weakness. So I don't know whether Paul, I mean, it's not as if God had not actually spoken to him before. We see that Paul has various encounters where he's actually talking to the risen Jesus or having a vision or that kind of thing. So it's possible that for our sake, you know, God gave him he gave him this thorn in the flesh and then actually explained to him verbally, this is why I did it, so that he could explain it to us and we would have this picture of, oh, okay, sometimes God leaves me weak with things that I would rather not, you know, they're a weakness and I would rather they were not a weakness. I would rather be strong there. And yet God does that so that in the end, my triumph can be seen to be, it wasn't because of my strength, but it was because of God's strength that it happened. It's possible, though, I think that that he could have just, you know, after praying three times and this isn't going away, I could imagine that he just contemplated the situation and said, you know, I don't think God intends to take this away. And the reason is, clearly, I mean, he understands enough to know why it is that God would do a thing like that. And I don't know which of those things is true. The only thing is, I tend to lean a little bit toward the he actually got a specific message from God thing, because I think it's pretty hard in the midst of the circumstances of our life to have any great confidence that we have figured out why God is doing any particular thing at any given time. So I think Paul needed something to indicate what it is that was going on. It might not have been a verbal message from God. It might have been a combination of circumstances that were so striking they said, "Oh, I mean, that's, you know, the writing's on the wall there," you know, or who knows. But I mean, you're right. It's not easy for us to say in the circumstances of our life, "This is why this is happening." And in fact, I think it's probably safer. Well, I think it's probably a good idea for us not to work too hard at trying to figure that out. At least, I'm familiar with this thing that used to happen in being Bible studies or prayer groups, and someone would come. It's like every week they're coming and they're saying, "Well, okay, you know, I got a flat tire, but I figured out that God wanted me to be there on that side of the road because I looked and I saw this sign." And it, I mean, you know, it's like they're always kind of coming up with, "Okay, now I figured out why it's okay. It's okay that this happened. God has sort of justified himself to me because he showed me why this thing had to happen." And the problem is, if you get in that habit, that what if something really big comes along and you can't figure out what it's there for? There comes a point at which we all have got to kind of take the Job route, which is, you know, Job had all this terrible stuff come to him, and when he said, "Why'd you do this?" God's answer was basically, "Let's review who I am and who you are." So, well, I mean, but you know, it's the striking thing in Job is he does not answer his question. He does not tell him why. I mean, in the story of Job, the way it's told, we know more than Job does about what's going on, the scene with Satan and the testing and all of that stuff. I mean, we know that there's a certain logic going on in this, but God doesn't give that logic to Job. And so I think all of us have to be prepared to say, it is not because I know how God is going to work this together for my good, but that I have every reason to believe his promise that he is, and with that I just have to be content. So we may not know. And if you're in a situation where you feel like you do know, that can be a very educational, very comforting thing. And sometimes that happens as we look back on circumstances in our life. We can say, you know, well, I may not know the whole story, but it is interesting that this thing, which was such a burden to me, has actually produced some very good things along the line, and that can be a very comforting thing, but it's hard to say. Is that kind of where your question was coming from?
Like Paul, when he got the answer, however that came to him, he was basically then free to not persevere in prayer. You know,
yes.
he didn't continue praying about that because he had gotten his answer.
Right.
Well, that wasn't something that God, you know, had promised.
Right.
So I guess I was thinking, so how do we, is there ever a time when we can stop praying, you know, because we don't get those
direct,
you know, answers from God, at least I don't.
Yeah. Oh, I see, yeah. Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I think there are two ways that I could come to the conclusion that I'm going to stop. Not so much I could, but I'm going to. One of them would be I become convinced I have had my answer. God has told, this is what God's going to do, and I'm just going to live with that. Or the other thing is I think I can come to that place where I feel I have made very clear to God what my desire is here, and I trust him. I'm not going to stop because I don't trust him, but I'm going to stop because I do. That is, I am content to wait to see how God does this thing. I don't feel compelled to be reminding him all the time, God, I trust you. Whatever you do here, I'm going to wait this out. And so I think in a way we can get to this place where to not ask can be a way of trusting, because I am at peace about it more than I was before. So either of those things could happen, I think. I'm not embarrassed to say that occasionally in my life something will happen that I just take as, it just seems so striking to me the way things happened, that I feel like God has said something to me. You know, I'm not a prophet or anything like that, but just, you know, they could be that kind of thing. I could imagine that my strength is perfected in weakness. I could imagine the circumstances of my life bringing me to a place where I could say, you know, I really think that that's what God's saying to me in this situation, that this is not going to change, but this is why. You know, I could imagine seeing things come together and actually feeling like that was what was going on. Always for myself, I always, with the proviso, I have to say, yeah, but I am no prophet, so I have to admit I could be reading this wrong, but it seems that way to me. So. Well, happy Halloween.